o'clock, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
And this is WBAI, 99.5 FM in your FM on your radio dial, and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood, program behind the news. And now we're joined by Jonathan Knitson, who teaches economics at York University in Toronto, and is the author of many books and papers, frequently with his collaborator Shimshon Bishler. And they have a lot of their material on the web at bnarchives.net, bnarchives.net. And I'll say that again at the end of this, but be sure to check it out. Lots of very interesting material there. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Good evening, Doug.
So just to start with, I was reading the Financial Times the other day that Israel will have no problem affording this war. It's no strain at all in its economy. What do you think of that?
Well, the Financial Times takes an aggregate status perspective. So Israel is a sort of a homogeneous entity. It's no longer a homogeneous entity from the perspective of the accumulation of capital. Therefore, it is entirely possible that most Israelis are going to suffer economically from that war. I don't think that the capitalists that operate in and from Israel will.
Now, is this war is it driven by economics, do you think, at least from the Israeli point of view?
It's a pretty complicated story, because to understand, I think, the conflict in the Middle East, you can approach it from a sort of a cultural, ethnic, religious perspective, which goes back quite a while. And you can approach it from a question of the processes of capitalism, and the picture that you get is quite different. So there are simmering conflicts all over the region. The question that we find interesting is how these conflicts actually fit into the broader picture of global capital accumulation, and the answers are often quite surprising. I do think that these conflicts have a lot to do with the accumulation of capital. I wouldn't call it economics, because it is a power process as well.
All right, well, let's first focus on the piece of land called Israel, even if it's not the self-contained national entity of elementary textbook economics. Tell us about the organization of the Israeli economy. What are its principal institutions, its principal sectors, and who owns it?
It's I think interesting to know that in the 1990s, the structure of the Israeli political economy has been really transformed fundamentally. Until then, it was a pretty closed political economy with heavy reliance on the military. So, for example, in the 1970s, military spending accounted for a full one-quarter of the gross domestic product of the country. Now they account for about 6%. So there's been a massive move away from a so-called war economy. Now, underlying this change, there was, in my opinion, a more fundamental change that concerns the globalization of ownership of the Israeli political economy. And that's not a process that is unique to Israel. It is a process that happened everywhere in the world. But Israel, because it is a small society, has been affected quite dramatically. So what we have now essentially is a capitalist class in Israel that is made of many foreign investors and large transnational corporations that own Israeli assets. For example, Warren Buffett, just a few months ago in May, I think, of 2006, spent about $4 billion to buy a company in Israel that is now under bombardment in the war from the Hezbollah in the war in Lebanon. So a lot of the assets of the Israeli political economy are owned by foreigners. At the same time, you have most of the Israeli owners actually invested elsewhere. So what once was something you can call the Israeli ruling capitalist class is no longer an Israeli capitalist class. Many of them are essentially global investors. So this entity now is very much intertwined with the global processes of accumulation. Now, domestically, it's less reliant on the military compared to what it was in the 70s and in 80s. So I wouldn't argue that this war at all is driven by so-called narrow economic interest in Israel. You cannot understand it independently of the U.S. policy in the Middle East.
And as I recall, the distribution of income in Israel is very, very unequal. It's almost American in its distributional structure, right?
This, again, is part of this process of globalization. So in the 50s, Israel was one of the more egalitarian countries in the world, and now it is, I think the inequality in Israel is probably greater than in the United States, and it's on par with many Latin American countries. So this is, again, part of the consequences of this movement towards globalization. The ruling class is less and less embedded in this country, and therefore it has less and less stake and less reason to worry on the social cohesion of that country.
Now, Israel, I think, has a lingering image in a lot of people's minds as the kibbutzes and the kind of socialist or social democratic ethos from its founding. Certainly, a lot of the Zionists came out of it, were also socialists of some sort. That world is long dead, isn't it?
Yes, it started to disintegrate in the 1970s. Many of the kibbutzim, in fact, started to bring in wage labor. They started to invest in the stock market. But most importantly, they were embedded in a country that was moving very rapidly towards a form of open liberal or neoliberal capitalism. So they couldn't really exist in that environment, and they have been capitalized and internalized into the system. So the kibbutzim as a political-economic model no longer exists.
Who were the corporate or financial or political elite who were driving this process of global integration and restructuring of the Israeli economy? It's a pretty small group of people, isn't it?
Well, you have anywhere between domestically between, I don't know, 10 or 18 families. But again, I wouldn't argue that they actually are driving the process. They have accepted this process in the early 1990s. And essentially, they had to decide whether they are keeping Israel as a closed political economy or they're opening it up. Once they've opened it up, they basically put their assets for sale, and in the proceeds they have diversified elsewhere. But they haven't been driving the process. They have basically accepted it. And we see similar processes, say, happening in South Korea now. So I wouldn't argue that the Israeli elite, that the economic or the business elite that dominated the country in the 80s actually drove the process. He simply accepted the global process that was taking place.
And when the current defense minister, Amir Peretz, was first taking office, he was cheered as some kind of revival of the old spirit of the organized labor in Israel. He's turned out not to be quite that, right?
It's interesting. Just a day or so ago, there was a piece in the newspaper in which it was indicated that many of the reservists are now very frustrated with the fact that the defense ministry is not allowing them to actually hold on their debt service, etc., while they are on reserve call in the north. And this is from, as they said, defense minister that is supposed to be socially oriented. So again, once he came into the job, he had to accept the parameters, and the parameters are that Israel has become, you know, a hyper neoliberal society. At the same day that this article was published in the newspaper, the government privatized its oil refineries, sold it for something like $800 million to one of Israel's big capitalists, and he was only too embarrassed, and he said that essentially all of this privatization of strategic assets was unnecessary, and tongue-in-cheek, he said the next step was to privatize the army, the IDF. So there you have it. You have, in the midst of the war, the government chooses to actually privatize strategic assets at the same time that it doesn't take care of its own reservists. It's an indication, I think, of the fractures that tear Israeli society, and you don't hear about it in the foreign press too much.
We also, we certainly know that there's an intimate political relation between the U.S. and Israeli governments. How deeply tied together are the economies of the U.S. and Israel?
They are very tied, and perhaps the best indication of that tie is if you look at the performance of the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange and compare it to the performance of the NASDAQ. So I'll be a little bit technical, but I'll try to explain myself because it's a pretty staggering picture. If you examine the correlation, which is a statistical measure of a co-movement of the rate of growth of these two stock markets, the ups and downs, in the 1980s, the correlation was negative. In other words, if the NASDAQ would go up, the Israeli market would go down. Nowadays, the correlation is almost perfectly positive. It's almost 100%. It's something like 95%. In other words, 95% of the movements of the Israeli stock market are explained by movements in the NASDAQ. That's an indication of how integrated these two business sectors have become.
And that suggests that the same pools of capital the same managers of those pools of capital are operating in both places.
Well, you can argue that the principles are identical, and I would accept that, yeah.
I should say I'm speaking with Jonathan Knitson, who is a professor at York University in Toronto and author of many books and papers, many of them in collaboration with Shimshon Bishler, who is based in Israel. And you can read a lot of their stuff on the web at bnarchives.net, bnarchives.net. You also have a very interesting theory of the role of oil, oil profits specifically, in explaining when wars in the Middle East happen. So could you lay out that scenario for us?
Well, as you've heard from your previous person on the show, much of the analysis of what happens in the Middle East is happening somewhere at the intersection of the disciplines of international relations, which are relations between countries, and international economics, mostly about resources, especially about oil. So most of the discussion is about state interests. And we have tried to look at some of the other interests that are involved, and we looked specifically at the oil companies. And what we have found was that if you consider the relative performance of the oil companies in comparison to the largest corporations in the United States. So you examine the rate of return of the oil companies and you contrast that rate of return with the same numbers for the leading companies in the U.S. It turns out that every time that the oil companies actually trail the average, in other words, the rate of return is below the leading company averages, there follows a war in the Middle East. And after the war in the Middle East, the performance of the oil companies actually shoots up. And this type of relationship has worked without fail since the end of the 1960s, including the last two Gulf Wars, the Gulf War of 1991 and the present conflict. So these numbers are quite remarkable in their systematic pattern. And, of course, you can dispense with that as being just a sort of a freak statistics. But the magnitudes involved behind them and the politics that we know about the oil companies in the Middle East suggest that that might be a little bit more than just a freak statistical coincidence.
Well, the profitability of oil companies is very heavily dependent upon the price of oil. So you can almost say that when the price of oil gets too low, it's time for a Middle East war.
Well, that's another interesting feature of the relationship between the Middle East and the profits of the oil companies. Most of the analysis of profitability centers both in conservative economics as well as among Marxist economists, focuses on the level of production. But in the case of oil, production is almost irrelevant. If you examine the history of the oil companies since the 1970s, all the variations in the profits are almost entirely explained by variations in the price of oil. The higher the price of oil, the higher the profits. So in the 1980s, when the price of oil in today's prices was roughly $90 a barrel, the oil companies globally accounted for about 20% of all global profits. Now, this ratio has gone down quite systematically, and at the end of Clinton's presidency, it has reached 3%. Now, since then, we know that the price of oil has gone up because, largely because of what is happening in the Middle East, and the oil companies have their share now of global profit at around 10%, and it will likely rise to about 15% a year from now based on current prices. Now, just to give you the overall magnitudes involved, over the past five or six years, yes, the four leading oil companies in the United States, based in the United States and in Europe, have earned the equivalence of $1 trillion in net profit, $1 trillion. So the question one needs to ask is very simple. If the oil companies are benefiting from higher prices, and higher prices are the consequence of the conflict in the Middle East, what interest do they have to actually terminate those conflicts?
And, of course, we can certainly see a deep affinity between the current leadership in Washington and the oil industry. You don't really you don't need a PhD in political science to figure that out. Those are a bunch of oil guys running the show. So here are the mechanisms pretty easy to see. But how does this the influence of the relative profitability of oil companies manifest itself or make itself known in the form of wars in the Middle East? I mean, what's the mechanism that by which the decline in profitability leads to some sort of tension and then an explosion into war?
Well, every conflict is different, and every conflict is, you know, is rooted in its own domestic and local circumstances. Without getting into the sort of institutional and historical details of every conflict, you can at the minimum say that every one of the significant wars that happened in the Middle East and that are related to oil, we call them energy conflicts, have taken place with the support, either active or passive, of the U.S. government at the time. And every one of those conflicts essentially could have been prevented or minimized had the U.S. administration wanted to. So the question that you probably want to ask yourself are, what are the specific mechanisms that connect the oil companies and the particular administration in office? Just in the last conflict, just before the conflict, we published a paper in which we said we don't have any concrete evidence on what happened behind the scenes, something like the Pentagon Papers that came out in the '70s, and maybe it will take another 20 years before we have the Exxon papers out that will tell us what happened in this particular conflict. Well, as it turned out, Greg Palast, the journalist, has just published recently a few pieces in which he claimed to have uncovered documents that suggested there were actually two coalitions in Washington. One coalition was made of the neoconservatives and the Pentagon that wanted to go in into Iraq, essentially immediately privatize Iraqi oil, flood the market and lower the price, and basically undermine OPEC. The other coalition that was made of the oil companies and elements within the Foreign Office essentially would have none of this sort of ideas, and they basically let the neocons carry out the operation, take over Iraq, and when this was completed, they put their own people there. And as we know, there has been no privatization of oil in Iraq. Iraqi oil production has basically deteriorated to almost nothing. And the United States now is a de facto member of OPEC because it rules Iraq, which is a member of OPEC. So this is an example of how this mechanism would work. Every situation is different. For me, the interesting set of facts are actually the statistical facts. The interest that the oil companies have in actually seeing conflict in the region. In fact, conflict in the region benefited not just the oil companies. It benefited the large companies in the world as well through the consequent inflation that has taken place.
Well, some people don't like it when some business sectors don't like it when oil prices are high. Certainly the airline industry is on the verge of death because of it. The auto industry doesn't like it. A lot of financial interests don't like it. Certainly bondholders don't like when inflation rises. So why don't the other sectors of capital gang up on the oil guys and send oil prices back down to $20?
Well, I actually disagree with this type of description. It depends on the circumstances because at the turn of the 21st century, the big fear was actually deflation. The big fear was that prices are rising at about 1% a year, and the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Greenspan, was talking about an unwelcome fall in inflation, and he was pretty much encouraged by bond investors of all, to actually go for higher inflation. This was a big, piece in the Financial Times at the time. This is 2003. So there was a big fear that inflation actually is too low and can turn into deflation with all the risks of debt deflation and falling profit, and et cetera. Now, what we see since the beginning of the hostilities in the region in 2002, 2003, we've seen a rise in inflation as a consequence, partly of the rising price of oil. And if you look at the performance of the corporate sector, the leading corporate sector, the Standard & Poor's 500, compared to wages, it's quite spectacular. Wages haven't moved, but profits have risen, and the correlation with the rate of inflation is almost perfect. In fact, the ratio of profits of the S&P 500 to the hourly wage rate has risen by 250% since the beginning of 2002. And I'm not saying it's entirely because of inflation, but it is very, very tightly correlated with inflation. It is no wonder, because if wages are not rising and you have a 4% inflation, most of it goes to profit. And since profit is a smaller proportion than wages, then the increase in profit is tremendous. So the other companies that are not involved in oil are not necessarily losers in that process. They actually ride on this rise in inflation, and they actually pocket all the benefits. And I think this is quite a significant reason why you hear nothing major in terms of opposition from other sectors in U.S. business to this war that supposedly is going to raise budget deficits and is raising the cost of raw materials and so on, because they're actually benefiting from it quite big time.
All right, thank you. I'm not sure I agree with you, but we're out of time, so we can't continue this conversation. I've been speaking with Jonathan Knitson, who teaches economics at York University in Toronto, and he and his frequent co-author, Shimshon Bishler, have a web archive where you can read a lot of their papers, bnarchives.net, bnarchives.net. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week, hopefully with Rasha Salty, who is based in Beirut and has been sending out amazingly moving and intelligent reports from the city under siege. And I should be able to, hoping to get an interview with her next week, which will run on the show next week if all goes well. Stay tuned for the news and on until the evening, and let's go out with a little bit more of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, Book 2. This is the first fugue.